Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
Calvin Coolidge.
Y'all are going to blow me up after you drop that shit.
When you started going into the Indian
treaties, yeah. I'm like, man.
Well, got to do something.
This is Political Breakdown from KQED in San Francisco. I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, it's our Friday look back at the week's top stories in politics, including a big win for Democrats in a special election for George Santos's House seat. U.S. Senate candidates here in California square off in a debate, laying bare the lack of interest or maybe the lack of knowledge about policy from one of the top candidates. Also, why Democrats are terrified that they might squander a chance to pick up a Central Valley House seat as two Democrats fight each other in an increasingly nasty primary. And up in Sacramento, organized labor revisits bills Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed last year. And the eternal question of what to do about retail theft continues bouncing around the halls of the state capitol, with today as the last day to introduce new bills. And here with me, as they are most Fridays, KQED politics correspondents Marisa Lagos and Guy Marzorati. Hey, y'all.
Hey, happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Well, of course, everyone knows today is the deadline for introducing bills in Sacramento, right?
We miss it.
I mean, come on. But it is. And so there's been a lot of talk about a couple of labor bills that the governor vetoed coming back, one having to do with autonomous trucks and the other having to do with unemployment insurance. Pick one, Guy, and why are they bringing this one back?
Well, I mean, the unemployment insurance was maybe the most controversial bill regarding labor passed last year in a summer in which, you know, organized labor had a lot of success in Sacramento. And this was one that would allow striking workers to qualify for unemployment benefits. This came at a time where we were seeing a lot of labor actions across the state, whether it was actors, screenwriters, hotel workers. The governor vetoed it. He really cited the unemployment fund that California has and the debt that it's accrued as kind of a big budget issue staring down at this bill. But labor's bringing it back again this year, which will be interesting to see because the characters in this have not changed, right? It's the same legislature that passed this bill last year. You know, the governor's has his critique of it. So it'll be interesting to see where this lands with the added elements of an election year. And you have Anthony Portantino, who carried this bill last year, introducing again this year. He's running for Congress, and so many folks in the legislature seeking either re-election or other office. That's kind of maybe the added element this year.
And well, he's not just running for Congress. He's running for Congress against several of his colleagues or former colleagues who also have like decent name ID. And it's sort of, I think, you know, one of those knockdown, drag out, dem on dem races where you need a way to.
You do. But, you know, the person who's really gotten the profile on this is Lorena Gonzalez, who is now the head of the California Labor Federation. She and Newsom have not been, I would say, the closest over the years. So why do you think this is somewhat personal for her, Marisa?
I don't need a text later. No, I mean, look, I think Lorena is passionate about what she does. And I think everything's kind of personal to her because she's the type of person that approaches her work in that way. I think you could say the same for Newsom in a lot of ways. I mean, he really, you know, I think sticks his neck out when he feels really strongly about it. I mean, clearly they both have a sense of the broader politics. And in her current job, I mean, this is what she's being paid to do, is advocate for workers, right? And so I think it makes sense. I mean, the question is, generally, when you see, you know, Newsom or another Democratic governor veto something that sort of aligns with his broader priorities, there's generally this like, well, we need to work on this or that. So I think the big question is like, are there going to be conversations happening? Is his office willing to engage, whether, you know, with Cal Labor or the author or other groups? Is there a middle ground they could come to? And I don't know the answer to that. Otherwise, it could just be, to Guy's point, sort of election year posturing where people like Portantino kind of get the win and push it forward. I mean, I think from a policy perspective, we also have to say it is not unusual for big sort of changes or controversial changes to take several years to kind of work their way through the process and get enough support, whether it be in the legislature or the critical mass outside, that makes a governor feel like, okay, this is worthwhile.
I mean, that's a great point. This bill last year was introduced pretty late in the legislative cycle. And it's a very complex piece of policy with a lot of, you know, stakeholders involved. So I think that the maybe more charitable view is they're bringing this back to give it a longer runway to come to some kind of resolution everyone can be down with.
So the other bill I alluded to is one that would require a human being to be sitting in an autonomous truck. This is, of course, a favorite bill of the Teamsters Union. The governor vetoed it last year, saying something loosely about, you know, being unnecessary or stifling innovation. But, you know, we've also seen problems with some of these autonomous vehicles here in San Francisco. Cruise has now lost its ability. The CPUC took away their right to drive in the city without anybody in the driver's seat. Of the two that we're talking about, to me, that seems a little less likely for Newsom to budge on because, the dynamics haven't changed that
much. And it's early yet. I mean, I think that it makes sense from a labor perspective that this is an issue you want to get behind. And obviously, this technology is moving quickly, but that one does seem like there's going to be a lot more sort of folks, you know, layers to it and questions that are open about the sort of mechanics and what the policy should look like. And I think you have to say, regardless of where you stand on this, that it is good that they are, you know, having this conversation, because a lot of stuff around we've talked about, like social media, they got caught real flat-footed around.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, another big issue that, Marisa, you have dug into a lot in the last several months is retail theft. And we saw this week Assembly leadership announce a bill that was going to really go after some of the professional retail thieves, I think. Tell us about that, because it's really sets up this question about Prop 47, the 2014 ballot measure that made it a little harder to prosecute retail theft, property theft for as a felony instead of a misdemeanor.
Yeah, I mean, not to toot my own horn here, but a lot of what they unveiled this week really tracks with what I found in my reporting, which is that many of these sort of problems that either are linked to 47 or at least perceived to be linked to 47 may not require that in itself to be changed, that it could, you know, or at least as a start that I think a lot of this stuff. And so we're talking about things. Yeah, like, you know, I mean, from the top end, it's like making sure that online retailers can prove that what they're selling isn't stolen, right? Putting more onus on these, you know,
platforms,
pretty mainstream actors who have arguably benefited from some of this behavior. They're also looking at, making it easier to do something that I found is one of the biggest problems, is that it's virtually impossible, even though the legislature has tried to tackle this issue, to essentially charge repeat thieves, you know, serial thieves with a felony, even if they're repeatedly going into the same group of stores and stealing, you know, just under that 950 threshold. And I think that, you know, that in itself could be a big, big win for the retail community.
I also think it's a lot of these changes were ones the governor proposed
Absolutely.
A few weeks back. And I think it just showed a real savviness on the part of the administration to get out ahead with solutions and really kind of redefine the problem here, right? It's like you have organized retail theft, you have shoplifting. The solutions are not the same for both. And I think by the governor getting out there and really focusing on stuff, to your, you know, reporting, if the issue is these things, shoplifting, that aren't resulting in arrests, focus on solutions that are about policing. So making it so for, you know, like you said, one of the not having to prove, not having to have an eyewitness for some of these shoplifting things, making it easier to aggregate charges. I think now it kind of shifts it back on some of these more moderate Democrats to why do you need to go back to the ballot now? Why aren't the things in this bill enough? And you saw a pretty interesting divide here at that press conference between Rick Sabur, who put forward some of these changes.
And who chaired that.
And who chaired that committee. And Kevin McCarty, head of the Public Safety Committee, running for mayor of Sacramento, who said, like, I'm leaving the option open to going back to the ballot.
Well, and of course, going back to the ballot, it's a lot harder. You got to raise money. It could divide Democratic interest groups. And so doing it through the legislature might just be quicker, and maybe address it more, in a more fundamental way anyway, without going back to the voters. All right, we're going to continue our conversation about the week in politics. You're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. We'll be right back.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app, Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, here with KQED Politics correspondents Guy Marzorati and Marisa Lagos. Let's talk about a very messy primary that has developed a congressional seat in the Central Valley. It's held now by Republican David Valadao. Democrats really saw this as a pickup and maybe still see it as a pickup opportunity. Rudy Salas, the now former assemblyman, came very close in 2022. He's running again, but so is fellow Democrat State Senator Melissa Hurtado. And Guy, it has set up a really nasty primary battle that leaves Democrats wondering if they're either one of them is going to make it into the top two.
Yeah, I think this you get to these weird machinations of the top two primary. And one of them is a situation like this where, depending how the vote share shakes out, Democrats are concerned that perhaps two Republicans, Valadao and another Republican,
a MAGA Republican,
could make it into the general election, essentially locking Democrats out of the general election. And we've seen this before. It happened a few years back in a state assembly seat in the Santa Clarita Valley, where Democrats didn't get their act together and two Republicans ultimately made it to the general election. This was the seat Christy Smith formerly held in the assembly. But the stakes here are so much higher. There's such a thin margin in the House, and taking back the seat is so key for Democrats nationally that, you know, the stakes here are a lot higher. If and it would just be a catastrophic result if it's for the party, if there's two Republicans in the general
election. Marisa, why do you think the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, why didn't they get involved? Did they take their eye off the ball on this, do you think? Because, you know, Hurtado was saying, well, Emily's List approached me and suggested that I run. They're now kind of backing away from that. I mean, this seems like a problem that could have been avoided.
It does, but, there's 435 congressional districts, right? I would imagine that they had sort of, I don't know, maybe they hoped that Hurtado would bow out or that, you know, there would be some sort of clarity leading up to this that would make it so that they, you know, that one of them would sort of take a step back. I mean, it is interesting when you see this. And, I mean, Hurtado's very young. She's only 35. I think she is run and legislated as more of an independent voice, and she's not necessarily kind of as yoked to the Democratic machine, you could say. And so, you know, this is like where I think often both parties, but particularly Democrats in this state, can get in trouble where, you know, they can talk and talk about wanting, you know, the best candidate out there and letting voters decide. But at the end of the day, like, they want to win, and that's more important in these races. And I do think from her perspective, she'd probably say, look, he's lost before. Like, why shouldn't I give this a try? And, you know,
well, she really hasn't raised very much money, I mean, compared to Salas. And now he's attacking her on in TV ads, one's in Spanish. This is a big Latino district. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Valadao has done a pretty good job of maintaining an image of being more moderate. You know, he voted for one of the articles of impeachment. A lot of people down there think he's Latino. He's actually Portuguese, but he's a farmer. Guys, is this going to be like kind of a stretch anyway for Democrats, and this like nasty intra-party, squabble kind of makes it harder, or does it all depend on who turns out?
Yeah, and I don't see this seat as a stretch. I mean, Democrats, given the registration in that district, I think Democrats look at this as a seat where if they get the right turnout, I mean, Valadao has lost before. Right. Mm-hmm. They've been able to get
in T.J. Cox. Remember
right,
that one?
Right. So I think it's definitely not a stretch for Democrats to imagine this being part of their strategy to take back the House, which just, you know, yeah, speaks to the importance of the race.
But to your point, like, Valadao has been pretty deft and been very good at sort of walking this middle line where he has really been loyal to the kind of hard right MAGA House, you know, Republican conference that's in charge. And yet I think still comes back to the district and really presents himself as a bit of a moderate voice. And I mean, I think, you know, I've spent a little time in that district. Like, you have to understand that this is not, even with when you look at the plus whatever it is Democrat voter registration, the issues that people care about on both sides of the aisle there are going to be very different than they are in coastal places like San Francisco, right? I mean, this is a place where farming and oil are big business, where things like gas prices, you know, just because of the both how big the district is and just like the economics of it, I think hit a lot harder than they might in some of these other places. And I think Valadao has been really good at kind of connecting with people on those issues and making them feel that he is representing their interests.
Yeah. I want to just real quick, there was a special election on Long Island this week. Tom Suozzi, Democrat, knocked off the Republican who was Jewish. And this issue of immigration came up, and, you know, Suozzi, a lot of, you know, the national political reporters are saying he's found the formula on dealing with border security and dealing with the Hamas-Israel war. Is that something that could translate, do you think, in a place like the Central Valley, where, you know, maybe immigration and border security are less of an issue because they rely on farm labor? I mean, is there any application of what Swazi did in New York to California?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. Not having followed that race very closely in Long Island, it seems like he, you know, towards the end spoke about this compromise on immigration that House Republicans ultimately, Senate Republicans ultimately voted down as maybe a way to say Republicans aren't serious about addressing this. Maybe, you know, you see that have some legs.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would question. It's interesting. There's been some reporting that shows that like Israel Hamas was like played huge, and that's a very Jewish district. I think there's a lot of other reporting and data showing that actually it was the way he really positioned himself by holding Biden at arm's length on other issues, right? Because Biden's been pretty supportive of Israel, you know, on the border security question. Abortion didn't seem to be a huge play there. So, yeah, I think that these are all things. I mean, certainly the idea of holding yourself away from this very unpopular president may be a winning strategy for a lot of folks in swing districts. And that's something, you know, that we've seen somebody like Biden, and I think it bears noting, like Nancy Pelosi, say in the past, right? Like, run against me, run with me,
just
win,
baby.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Last, I want to talk about the Senate race, which is happening. There was a debate this week with the top four, the three Democrats, and Steve Garvey, the Republican. And we were all talking afterwards about Steve Garvey, who seems to be, you know, very possibly going to make it into the top two. And he was asked a question about housing. And he kind of, his answer kind of revealed what? His lack of experience, would you say?
There were a couple of really questionable moments with Garvey in that debate. One, as you mentioned, he was asked, what's one housing regulation that you would repeal? He's talked about these onerous regulations on developing housing, and he couldn't name one. Then there was another moment of this where he was asked about whether he would accept an endorsement from Donald Trump. And the answer, it was like as if Nikki asked, like, are you circumcised? Like the way you can play the clip, but it was just like, let's hear that.
These are personal choices. I answered to God, my wife, family, and to the people of California. And I hope you would respect that I have personal choices.
The question was,
I'm not going to be able to get an image out of my head.
The question was, would you accept an endorsement from Trump? Like, yeah. Seems like a very relevant question for voters. And beyond just the, like, his answers, I do think the strategy question here, to me, a Republican who just wants to get into the general election would say, I love an endorsement from Trump.
Yeah,
I would embrace, you know, winning a general election is going to be so difficult. Let's just focus on getting past March. And it's unclear to me what's Garvey's strategy?
He must, like, in his head think maybe he can win and he's going to turn off people if he embraces Trump. I mean, is that who maybe, knows?
I mean, and to take it back to the voters, like, why does this matter? I do think you're setting up a scenario where voters are really not going to get a real robust conversation about the future of governance in this state, potentially if Garvey's the candidate, because it's at that point, are we even going to have debates between him and a Democrat? And even at these debates, he seems kind of unwilling to engage with a lot of the questions that he's
asked. I mean, set aside, say you don't think it's relevant or you don't care, you think that, you know, the moderator shouldn't push him on the Trump vote, which I got to give credit to. I think Nikki did a really good job of trying to get into this stuff. I think they were hampered, honestly, by some of the time limits and like that, you know, you're not going to go back 16 times to the same person. But he couldn't answer a simple question about housing regulation. Like that's a gimme question. Like, is there one regulation you would change? It's CEQA, guys. It's the Republican handbook. Like, it's not even that hard. I mean,
It just shows, I think, it's just his lack of interest in policy or knowledge, or maybe just not being very quick on his feet. I don't know. But you could make something sound plausible if you don't know what CEQA is.
Yeah. Like, to me, that felt like just like, not as prepared, because you could argue that in some of these policy areas, again, he doesn't want to kind of put too sharp of a point on his position so that he can appeal to a wide range of people. This didn't seem like that. I will say another funny moment was asking, you know, a stage full of people, two of whom 75 or over if Donald Trump and Joe Biden are too old. Which both Barbara Lee and Steve Garvey, 75 and 77, are like, no, you know. Or like.
But there were it was so clear Adam Schiff was at many times throughout that debate invoking Garvey's name in the hopes of, as we've talked about previously on this show,
triggering a response,
getting him more airtime. And there were a lot of times where Garvey was just like, I'm good.
One-word answers. All right. We're almost out of time, but Monday is President's Day. By the way, we're not going to have a show on that day. But we were talking before we started recording here, like, how are we going to ask a President's Day question? So just a very general question. Give a shout-out to a former president, maybe someone you'd like to have dinner with or something, living or dead. Marisa?
All right. I'm going to go with a little sleeper hit, Calvin Coolidge, for his...
Silent Cal.
For his... support of women's suffrage and honestly racial equality at a time when that was like not a big Republican priority, signed the Indian Citizenship Act, giving Native Americans the right to vote.
Did you know that?
Wikipedia?
No. Yeah, I did Wikipedia because you asked me 5 minutes ago to pick a president. And I knew that if I picked anyone in our lifetime, I would not have a job anymore.
Well, according to Wikipedia, Warren G. Harding died in San Francisco.
You knew that
so
before
he's going to get my shout out today.
All right. Well, we're going for, presidents who died in your hometown. I'm going to go with Theodore Roosevelt. He didn't die, but he took the oath of office in Buffalo, New York, down on Delaware Avenue. I grew up in the city when McKinley was shot and killed. Youngest president ever, 42 years old. First American to win the Nobel Prize and like a Republican who cared about the environment. So I think he'd be fun to have dinner with, right?
Yeah.
As long as you're serving like meat, you think he's the kind of guy who would want to. He's not a vegan, that's for sure. All right.
You might have to hunt it yourself or something.
Yeah, with him.
Taft's not on the table.
Yay. All right. Have a good weekend. Thanks for joining us.
And thanks, Scott.
That's a wrap for Friday, February 16th. Political Breakdown is a production of KQED. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Izzy Bloom. Our team includes Marisa and Guy and Molly Solomon and Otis R. Taylor Jr. and Ethan Tobin Lindsay. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thank you so much for listening.